Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
It's mentally yours.
Hello and welcome back to Mentally Yours, Metro.co.uk's mental health podcast. I'm Rachel Moss, and today I'm going to be joined by Jake and Hannah Graff, a transgender couple who met in 2015 and have since had 2 children together. They shared their story with the world through the Channel 4 documentary, Our Baby, A Modern Miracle. And this summer, they've released a book called Becoming Us, a story of transgender love, joy, and family. We'll be talking about their lives, transphobia, and the impact on their mental health. But before that, we've been hearing from you. As always, you've been getting in touch to let us know what you've been doing to support your mental health this week.
As soon as I start to feel that funk and I'm maybe feeling a little bit down or a little bit anxious, I find just getting outside, breathing in fresh air, sort of reminding myself that we are connected to nature, I find that's a really good way to sort of get out of your own head.
Sometimes with my mental health, it just helps to go back to basics and check that I've been outside and that I have had a shower. And also, yeah, just how powerful it is to go for a walk. I find it really grounding and can really clear my head. And I love being in nature.
So Jake and Hannah, thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start by just recapping a bit of your personal story as a couple, because it is a pretty special one and some listeners might not be familiar with it. So Jake, you started your transition in 2008 and Hannah, you came out as trans in 2013. And I remember at the time you were all over the news because you were one of the highest ranking soldiers in the British Army to come out as trans. But how did you two meet? When did the romance start?
It actually started because I had seen Hannah, as you say, all over the British media. Hannah was outed against her will on the front pages of one of our national red tops. And obviously it was a big story because she was the highest ranking transgender officer in the British military at the time. And she had decided that she would try and sort of guide the narrative and make it a positive piece. And so had worked with the Sun to make it so. And so it was one of the first positive pieces that we'd seen about a trans person ever in the British media. And I'd seen her on Lorraine and I'd seen her on Victoria Derbyshire. I'd seen her on The One Show and she really got around. And every time I thought, you know, this girl's very attractive and very eloquent and very, seemed very humble, very shy. And so I, actually she popped up on my Facebook, People You May Know, and I added her, you know, quick click of a button. And about an hour or so later, although Hannah will tell you now that it was longer, it really wasn't. Hannah messaged back to say, been watching your exploits with lots of interest. Think what you're doing is great. Because I, at the time, was working on The Danish Girl and making various films and so on. And she said, you know, I think what you're doing is great and, you know, would be great to meet at some point. Love Hannah. So I thought, well, obviously there's a little bit of interest, a little bit of keenness there to at least, you know, have a drink or get to know each other a bit. And so we started flirting on Facebook in what can only be called the most mortifying Facebook flirtation ever. It wasn't smooth. It wasn't cool. Luckily, it worked for both of us. And after about a week, I managed to get her on the phone. And you know, Hannah's got quite a deep voice and felt quite self-conscious about that. And so didn't want to get on the phone and wanted to do a Skype. This was in the days of Skype. And I said, well, obviously, that's a really weird thing to do, like when we haven't ever met, to do a Skype like that. So I finally managed to get her on the phone.
Ahead of my time, by the way.
Yeah. And so I managed to get her on the phone and we had a lovely conversation and we arranged to make a date for a few days later on the 30th of December, 2015. And so we actually had a first date that lasted 11 hours. I arranged to meet her at 3 o'clock in the afternoon because I thought, you know, it was Christmas time. If things all went horribly wrong, then I would still be able to go and see my friends at 6 o'clock. But it was great. We met at three. I was Hannah's first ever date, which was obviously good for me because she had no point of reference whatsoever. And we just clicked, you know, from the first moment I saw her, I thought, what a beautiful woman. And that's very unusual for me. And we walked along the South Bank. She wasn't very familiar with London. So walked along the South Bank. It was a sunny December day. We had a few drinks. We talked about everything from family to dreams, to hopes, to aspirations, to careers, to kids, everything but being trans. And it was such a massive relief to speak to somebody who knew what dysphoria was, who knew all about transitions and hormones and all of that without worrying about coming out or disclosing or the stigma of being trans. And it was wonderful. And as I say, we had, you know, we were together all that evening. We had our first dinner at eight. We had our first kiss at nine. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, we were sitting in a very private, wonderful military bar that was open after hours, drinking tequila until about two or three. And, I put Hannah on her train home and off she went. And we saw each other the very next night again, which was the 31st of December, and have never looked back.
And the rest, as they say, is history. What a great way to start. Hannah, you said there, Jake, you spoke about your kind of dreams and things for the future on your first date. Hannah, obviously, if we fast forward today, you two have got two beautiful children together. Did you always want to become a parent? And for you, did you imagine that that might happen?
I wouldn't say I'd always wanted to become a parent, but that was mainly because the idea of parenthood felt a bit unobtainable for me. You know, as Jake said, he was my first ever date. And, you know, I grew up learning to feel like trans women were ugly, something to be despised, something to be fearful of. And so the idea of being able to transition and then even dating sounded crazy, let alone getting married, having kids. And so it just was sort of out of my frame of reference for a long time. And then after meeting Jake and realizing that, you know, you can have a relationship and knowing that it was a really big part of what Jake saw for his future, that's when it started to click as a genuine possibility. And it was by no means an easy process or something to be taken lightly. But as our relationship grew, I sort of got more interested in the idea. And actually, yeah, it was very exciting. Yeah, it was very exciting.
Yeah, I love it. So it's just, you know, magical to think about. Jake, I know for you, it was something that was quite important and you froze your eggs before you'd even met Hannah and you paused your transition for that. I can't imagine the impact that must have had on your mental health. Do you mind sharing with us a little bit what that was like for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, growing up, I'd always got on with kids. I worked as a nanny for years pre-transition. I'd always sort of, you know, at the wedding, be the person who'd say, oh, don't worry, I'll look after your kids for a bit and take them off and run around. And for me, it was not dissimilar to Hannah. I always imagined that a trans person wouldn't have kids, wouldn't have a family, wouldn't have all those things, because that is what the media, that is what the narrative tells you, that trans people aren't worthy or deserving of that love and of that, you know, normality that everyone strives for, and the 2.4 children and the you know, house and the career and so on. And so I had also allowed myself to feel that I would not be a father, that it was just not there for me, it was not attainable. And it was only 6 years into my transition, and obviously, you know, even getting to transition took me until I was about 28 years old. It was a really long, hard road. And when I eventually got there, I think the fact that I got so much support, and, you know, it's a huge thing transitioning. And I think for me, finally finding myself in the right body and being able to like what I saw in my reflection, and all of that built confidence that I'd never had in my life before, just because I finally felt comfortable in my own body. And so 6 years in, and it did take at least 6 years before I really felt comfortable in myself, and knowing myself to be the man that I knew I'd always known myself to be, but really feeling it. And I thought harvesting eggs was obviously going to be emasculating. It was going to be difficult. It was going to be invasive, intrusive, uncomfortable, all of those things. But if it gave me even the slightest glimmer of hope that I might one day be a father, be a parent, then that to me was worth it. And so I, with the help of my mother, because I was single at the time and I wasn't very affluent, and obviously, you know, for trans people, there is none of that on the NHS. And so I knew that if I was going to do it, it would have to be privately funded. So my dear old mum, who has been my champion throughout my life, said, if this is something that really matters to you and this is something that you feel very, very strongly about, then I will help you and I will support you. And so I went through what was honestly not as bad as I thought. I think by that point, I was so confident in my masculinity, in the man that I was. Of course, it was tough. Of course, you know, my biology doesn't necessarily line itself with who I know myself to be. But at the same time, I'd gone through so much by then anyway. I just kind of steeled myself. I stopped testosterone for 6 months. I got more weepy. My muscle dropped a bit. You know, nothing else really changed. It wasn't the greatest time in my life. All of my friends were very concerned about me. In fact, I had a lot of friends who'd read that if you take a trans person off their hormones, they can become suicidal. So I did have a lot of friends who were very, very concerned for me during that time. And, you know, I had a lot of people say, call us anytime, day or night. But honestly, I had an end goal in sight and I stood strong and I had my mother by my side and my friends were very supportive. I had a lot of really, really great people in my corner. I went through the process and honestly, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And I was left with 5 embryos on ice, which was incredible. So I was advised once the eggs had been harvested that it would be better to have them fertilized at that point because your chances of a viable pregnancy and their baby hugely grow from, I think, about 20% to 50. So for me, it was a no-brainer. And I just, you know, I had them fertilized, chose a donor, had them fertilized, 5 embryos on ice. So when I actually got on the phone to Hannah for the first time, within about 5 minutes, I said, look, you know, honestly, I am looking for marriage and children, and I do have 5 embryos kind of waiting. So if that's not for you, then let's just cut this off now. And to Hannah's enormous credit, because I don't think many people would have stayed on the call, Hannah kind of nervously said, that's not something I'd necessarily be close to. And so we kept talking. And as you say, here we are.
Yeah, amazing. Nobody listening to this will be able to see that I'm just beaming listening to this story. It's so nice that you were so open to that. And your mum sounds like the most brilliant, supportive person in the world. And I'm sure a very, very proud grandmother. Because with the help of a surrogate, you've now got 2 lovely children. You've shared your parenting journey really publicly, first through a Channel 4 documentary and now your book. Why was it important for you to share it with the world? Why did you want to show the world your family?
One of the biggest challenges that we face as a community of trans people is that there aren't that many of us, relatively speaking, to the population. So the vast majority of people have never met a trans person. And so their only point of reference is what they've watched in movies or read in the media or pick up in the newspaper, you know, and read. And unfortunately, there is a large skew again across all mainstream media that is quite negative towards trans people. Our experience is that when people get to know us, when people meet us, they quite often have those perceptions. And then when they meet us and get to know us, they realize that some of those things aren't true or they're lacking context or they aren't what they thought them to be. And therefore, they come away from it much more positive outlook on trans people in general. And so what we hope to do by sharing our story is to allow more people to have a little bit of that experience so that next time they read something in the media about trans people, they don't necessarily take it at face value. And potentially even better, if they meet someone in real life that's trans, they'll have a better idea of what that might mean and hopefully have a better experience of interaction in society in general. So I guess we just hope by being honest and open about our stories that people will be a little bit more understanding of trans people.
Yeah, I don't like the word normal or normalized, but I suppose it is just to kind of try and normalize that experience because, you know, when Hannah says that the media is quite negative, I think that's really very kind to a media which is utterly vile. And, you know, to sort of say that it feels very much like a campaign, a propaganda campaign kind of against the trans community, against trans people at the moment, I don't think is sort of, you know, falling too short of the reality of it, unfortunately. And, you know, it's a scary time to be trans. And they're writing about us now in the same way that they were writing about gay men in the 80s and about people of color some 100 years ago. You know, we are to be feared. We are a minority that's people should be wary of. And, you know, we are maligned. We are told that we're infringing on other people's rights. You know, that this argument that is constantly peddled that trans women are impacting on the rights of cisgender women, which obviously are the same arguments that white people were using against black people 100 years ago. But we can't let them in our spaces and in our bathrooms because they'll be taking away my white rights. And, you know, we heard it when gay men came out in the 80s, when men would say, well, I wouldn't want to stand at the urinal next to a gay man. They should have their own, you know, they should have their own bathrooms, their own toilets, their own spaces. And it's this same tired argument. It's not about bathrooms. It's about squashing down a minority and keeping them in their place. And this is what's going on at the moment, unfortunately. We have a government that is not supportive. We have a prime minister who is very ignorant on what it is to be transgender and seems determined to make it harder for young trans people and indeed for trans adults. You know, it's for us, it is a very worrying time. And whilst walking through the world, we meet only really largely very kind people. And the reaction to our documentary was thousands, quite literally, of messages of support and kindness and understanding and empathy. And the same for our book that we recently released. You know, we've just had so much positivity and kindness and people saying, I've read your book and it's helped me understand. It's helped my son. It's helped my brother, sister, mother. It's, you know, what we see from the media is in direct conflict to what we see walking through the world. Thank goodness, because otherwise the world would be a very, very scary place.
Yeah, absolutely. How does it make you feel when you see that kind of narrative, some of the media? What's the impact on your mental health for both of you?
There are honestly many, many evenings where we sit on our sofa once the kids have gone to bed, just shocked and rocked and hurt and worried and scared. And not, I think there is honestly a real feeling of why. Why are we so hated? Why are we so maligned? Why are we so attacked? Why is it still okay for the media, for public figures, for our government to be so unkind and so dangerous towards our community, so utterly lacking in empathy, so fear-mongering? I think there is, you know, certainly from Hannah and I, and I think the rest of our community feels very similarly, it is hard enough to be born trans, just like it's hard to be born gay or it's hard to be born any kind of minority where you're being persecuted just because of the way you're born. To find yourself already struggling with that and then to have so much hate because of that, something over which you have no control, it does leave you feeling battered and bruised and scared, honestly.
I'll give you a little like taster of, I was in work the other day and I was briefing a group of people, and around in the office there's TV screens showing the news, you know, sort of rolling news. And it, behind me as I was presenting, there was a big headline that was going across the entire time I was talking. It just said transgender rapist. Imagine any other minority substituted for the word transgender there and think how we would feel about that being the headline on national news rolling through the day. I looked at it thinking like it was just depressing and it was just frustrating because I like to think of myself as a good person trying just to, in that instant, just do my job. And I've got that literally hanging over my head. And one of the things that at least Jake and I have is each other, supportive families, supportive friends, our own family, which brings us immense joy. And so it hits us. We have somewhere to retreat to. We have something positive in our life to make us feel better. I have Jake. We can switch off and go and cuddle our kids. And, you know, it gives you a sense of perspective and it helps manage that feeling. But imagine all of those young people, not even young people, all those people who are maybe don't have that support or are struggling or in a community that isn't accepting, and they have nowhere to go apart from just to live in that really sort of negative headspace. And that must grow and grow and grow, which is why you see such a correlation between mental health struggles and LGBTQ+ community. And it's a very sad state of affairs. And it's something, again, one of the reasons why we hope by sharing our stories, we might combat that.
Yeah, I mean, I this is just a sort of an aside to that. But at the moment, the government is actually suggesting revisiting all their measures around trans young people in schools. And amongst some of those measures are having, you know, telling the parents basically if a child is societally transitioning at school and this is their only safe space, what our government is proposing is that those those children would have to be reported to their parents if their parents were not aware and if their parents were not supportive. So if your parents aren't supportive, all of a sudden you have no safe space whatsoever. So for those young people who have no safe space at home, all of a sudden they're about to be outed at school by the very people that they might have come to trust at school. And the other suggestion is that if a young person's transition is affecting the mental health of the other students, then that young person will effectively have their transition vetoed and stopped. I mean, this is the world that we've come to, that trans people and trans young people are so irrelevant and so unimportant to the current government that another child could say, or another parent could say, oh, my child's mental health is affected by this young person living authentically and happily, and therefore their transition could be stopped or they could be removed from the school. It's a world gone mad. And I know that there will be people who will listen to this and who will say, well, they're all sick, it's disgusting, they've chosen this and there are only two sexes. And, you know, what we get told a lot, I'm biologically female, I'm biologically male, and, you know, we shouldn't have the right to have kids and all of these horrible things that people say. I just sincerely hope that those people who are putting that out there have a very good reason and have really wondered what that reason is for writing the hateful comments and for piling on whenever Hannah and I post a happy picture of us or our kids, and just wonder why you're doing it. What really are you scared of? Or is it just that you're reading in the newspapers that we're bad people and going along with that just for the ride?
Yeah, it's, I mean, how much more can you say on it? I agree. It's a nasty, nasty world out there and there's a lot of injustice going on. And I think the way you're talking about supporting each other and dealing with it is kind of all you can do in that kind of situation. Is there anything else you do to support your mental health? You've said you lean on each other, but for maybe some younger trans people out there who haven't got a partner or someone they feel that they can lean on, do you have any advice for dealing with all of the negativity?
I mean, there are massive groups. There are huge groups across social media now. So obviously social media has its downsides, but it certainly has its plus sides. When I was transitioning, I didn't know anyone trans at all. I found an amazing YouTube FTM community, free multi-male community on YouTube, and they went through every step of the transition with me. And I followed them and I watched them and I really felt that I wasn't alone. And now obviously, you know, there are so many more groups and so much more support and, you know, young people, huge groups and huge people are followed on TikTok who are also sharing their transitions. You know, there is a lot of support out there. But what I would say is if you're getting negativity online, firstly, block and delete because it's just not worth it. And try and remember that, you know, those people who are putting hate out there are hateful people. They are sad. They are unhappy. And honestly, they hate themselves a lot more than they hate you, because it is fact that happy people who are satisfied with their lives, who are satisfied and look out at the world and think, what a beautiful world, what a beautiful day. I'm so lucky and my family's wonderful and, you know, things are good. They don't bother wasting their time putting hate out online and attacking us or attacking you or attacking anyone else. So just remember that. I know it's a sort of, you know, when someone's being horrible to you, it's really hard to sort of feel any kind of pity or empathy or kindness, dare I say it, for them. But just sort of remember, you know, after you've blocked and deleted them, that these people are very, very unhappy and most of the time have just been fed a load of nonsense and unfortunately have chosen to believe it. So try and feel a little sadness for them and just get on with your life and be the happiest person you possibly can, because you deserve that.
I would also just say, if possible, and it isn't always possible, if possible, try to seek out a group or a community in the real world. I think makes a big difference. Human connection, you know, will always surpass, you know, online interaction in my view. So I really think that where that's possible, you'll get a lot more from a face-to-face coffee with someone than you will doing, you know, interacting messages online. You can get a lot more across and you can feel more connected to the world and get away from the screens, which are quite often the source of the sort of negativity in the first place.
I'm really glad that we've spoke about the challenges and the injustices facing the trans community at the moment, because obviously those things are really, really important. But I also wanted to talk about trans joy too, and some of the brighter sides of trans life, because I feel like we just don't hear about those things enough. Body dysphoria is obviously something we hear a lot about in relation to the trans community, because that's a really important issue. But I wanted to chat to you both about body euphoria. Are there any moments that spring to mind when you've really felt great in your body, when you thought, I feel euphoric, this is me, this is who I am?
I mean, yeah. And again, there is this misconception and this nonsense online that, you know, trans joy isn't a thing. Of course, trans joy is a thing. There are now so many successful, happy trans people who are living successful, happy, and I this stupid word again, normal, but just usual lives. You know, we've got friends who are trans, who are models, who are activists, who are singers, who are doctors, who are police, who are teachers, who are across the spectrum, who work in every single field and who are happy and who are supported by their families and who are at various stages of transition. You know, there is this misconception, and I think it is one of the arguments that trans joy is just not a thing and that, you know, we're all regretful and we're all so unhappy and we're all, I can attest that that is utter nonsense. And most of our friends and Hannah and all of these young people that we know from the Mermaids Charity, from, you know, from the Albert Kennedy Trust and all these trans young people that are allowed to either socially transition or in our case, medically transition, most of us, and, you know, of course, there are a few people that, don't fall into that category, as there are with any kind of medical anything. But most of us are joyous. Most of us, once we've had our either our top surgeries or for some people lower surgeries or for some people no surgeries, it's just being referred to by the correct pronouns or by the correct name. We are joyous because we feel acknowledged and we feel comfortable and we can look in the mirror and finally like what we see. And whether that's, as I say, a combination of hormones or in some cases surgeries, then there is that joy. You know, I remember the first time I looked at my flat chest that had haunted me my whole life and meant that I walked bent over and uncomfortable. And I was so disgusted by what I saw in the mirror. Once I had my top surgery, I was able to stand tall and walk tall and wear a tight t-shirt and love it. And every other person that I know, and those are hundreds of people, hundreds of trans men that I've spoken to, absolutely love it. That feeling of elation and freedom and being able to take your top off on the beach for the first time after your surgery is utter euphoria. And, you know, as I say, for a lot of people, that then follows lower surgery. And for some people, it's just getting buff in the gym. And for some people, it's when they first grow their beard. And, you know, as I say, it's those little tiny things. I remember when I first got my first one whisker, the joy that I felt because I had one whisker. And, you know, first I had like a little sort of chin strap for about 2 or 3 years. And then I got a tiny little bit of a moustache. And just, you know, again, little things that just, it's not really about the aesthetic. It's about making us feel like the gender that we know ourselves to be, the correct gender, those tiny little things. And they just make all the difference.
Hannah, have you got any euphoric moments you'd like to share with us?
Of course, there are elements of my physical transition that have brought me huge amounts of joy and happiness because it's, you know, aligning myself to how I feel. But my euphoria really comes from just the sort of sense of inclusion and acceptance in my day-to-day life. That's where when those moments of physical transition happen, yeah, it's great at the time, but they soon become just the everyday. And really, it's about those, that ongoing feeling of like being accepted for who you are in your day-to-day life. And it's the little tiny things, you know, it's just the way people address you or the, you know, the terminology they use, the pronouns, dare I say, you know, they all make a big difference. And actually, it's a sort of constant state of euphoria when your identity is validated, supported and included.
There's a really nice bit in a part in our book, because obviously, you know, when Hannah and I read each other's parts in the book, each other's chapters, we both discovered a huge amount about each other that we never knew, because, you know, there's only so much you can tell a partner, and there's only so much, you know, that you would share, just because a lot of it seems a bit dull. But obviously, when you're writing your entire life out in a book, there was a lot of stuff about Hannah that I read that I had no idea of, and vice versa. But I remember a part where Hannah said, you know, the first time that she walked past a soldier and he called her mom instead of sir, and her heart sang. What a lovely moment that must have been for her, you know. And I suppose I really can't remember my first he. So it's those little moments that just mean the world to us. And also, you know, what you've got to remember is all these people who are sort of negating that and, you know, trying to tear us down and telling us we don't have trans joy, and we're here, we're telling you we do. And also, why do you care? And more importantly, why would you want to deny that another human being has, or even if they just claim to have, joy? It's a really strange time in history where a group of humans are absolutely adamant and want to be incredibly vocal about the fact that another group of humans who already have a pretty rough end of the deal aren't joyous and don't deserve joy. And we can attest from ourselves and from our community that there is a vast, endless amount of joy out there. And, you know, the more we are visible, the more we see people coming out, the more we get, Hannah and I probably get about 100 messages a week from people, not just young people, but from people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, saying to us, you know, I never knew that I could be myself. I never knew what I was. And I've seen people like you, and I've seen your families, and I've seen other trans people, and I now realize who I am. And it is an incredible thing, because we're seeing more and more people like us, and we're realizing we're not the tiny, tiny little minority we thought that we were.
What a brilliantly positive note to end on. But before I let you go, I've got one final question that we ask all of our Mentally Yours guests. And that's, what's the most important lesson that you've learned about mental health that you'd like to share with our listeners? And I'm going to get you both to answer it.
So I think for me, for years, I tried to squash everything down. I really struggled with alcoholism when I was younger. I was desperately unhappy. I knew that I was trans from the age of 3, desperately unhappy, tried to numb it all, tried to ignore it all, tried to run away from it all. And I know now that, you know, when I feel down, I will talk to Hannah about it. I will talk to my friends about it. I will even talk to my mum about it. And sometimes, as Hannah says, what you really need is just a quiet night on the sofa with someone you care about, to cuddle your kids or to cuddle your dog or your cat or your hamster, you know, a little bit of time away from it all. Turn off your phone, read a book, you know, go out into the fresh air. And I think, you know, as I say, having spent a good 15 years of trying to drink my way to sanity, that it does not work. I think, you know, you've got to kind of try and talk about these things. That for me would be it. Like, talk these things through, because everyone around you, friends and family, everyone's going through something. And that is absolutely true. And most people will want to talk.
Hannah, what about for you?
One of the things that I found coming out as trans is that I didn't think for a long time that I was trans enough, because I didn't meet a certain stereotype of what I thought, you know, being trans was. And I suppose the lesson there, for I hope other people could take away, is you know who you are. Don't doubt who you are. It doesn't mean you have to come out right now, or you have to be something in that moment, or have to tell everyone in that moment, but don't doubt who you are.
It's mentally yours.
Thank you so much to Jake and Hannah for being our guests this week on Mentally Yours. If you've been affected by anything you've heard today, please call the Samaritans on 116 123. You can find us on our Facebook group, Mentally Yours, and on X or Twitter at MentallyYRS. And get involved. Tell us what you've been doing to support your mental health this week. Message Pineapple Audio Production on Instagram with your voice note. Thank you for tuning in, and don't forget to follow and review for more podcast episodes coming your way soon. Mentally Yours is produced by Pineapple Audio Production. Bye for now.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.